Today's episode is sponsored by Empower. It doesn't matter how much money you have, we all have money questions. Empower has the tech with a real-time dashboard and the people to help you take control of your financial future and empower what's next. Start today at empower.com. Lauren.
Mike.
Do you think that chatbots are too woke?
Mike, this intro is terrible already.
I'm sorry, I do not make the rules.
Who makes the rules then?
Some artificially intelligent agent that has been coded with biases, apparently.
The future is so bright.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Well, to answer your question, I think the power of chatbots is at the moment overstated. And I think we have yet to see what these companies are actually building AI for. But we should probably talk about what is going on with the so-called woke chatbots.
I agree. So let's get to it.
Let's do it.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Gadget Lab. I am Michael Calori, Wired's Director of Consumer Tech and Culture.
And I'm Lauren Good. I'm a senior writer at Wired.
And once again, we are joined this week by Wired senior writer Paresh Dave. Paresh, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
It's always good to have you here. And you were just here a couple weeks ago, so it's like a quick repeat.
Yes, but we have important stuff to talk about.
We do. Today, we are going to be talking about Google. The last few months have been rough for Google. Company executives have been in the hot seat because of some embarrassing missteps. The one that was probably the most awkward was the bungled launch of Google's latest image generator. The company launched it and then quickly pulled it back after it produced some seriously weird results that everybody was sharing on social media. Later on in the show, we're going to talk about some of the staffing pains that Google has been going through in recent months. But first, we're going to dig into the product side of things. So Paresh, if you can help us out and bring us all up to speed on what Google Gemini is and how the most recent launch played out.
Yes. So Gemini, used to be known as Bard, is a chatbot where users just like ChatGPT can enter prompts, get back responses. One new feature that you were just alluding to that they rolled out was an image generator, similar to what people might know as, you know, Stable Diffusion or DALL-E, where you can enter in a prompt and you get an image or a series of images back. And what happened is basically when you would sort of put in an image that involved, let's say, a race or something from history, people started noticing that Nazis started becoming black. Vikings started having very strange looks. And it just, you know, it didn't make sense and it offended some people. And that became a huge firestorm of criticism for Google over the last couple weeks.
So for a long time, the concern with some of these biases around AI tools is that they would preference white people, non-people of color. In this instance, the opposite was happening.
Exactly. They had, in the words of some conservatives, turned on the woke engine, and not in a good way.
But really what was happening probably was an overcorrection, right?
Yes. So there's a couple of things here that are interesting behind the scenes, right? There's one filter where you're kind of saying how random you want your response to be. So these generators, these generative AI technologies, basically choose, as someone sort of put it to me, like the average of the internet. But sometimes you want to stray from the average a little bit, and how much you want to deviate is one of the important dials that these companies control. And so that could have been tuned a little bit off. And then second, there's these filters that companies like Google put on top of the responses. So let's say you ask for an image of a CEO, the image generator choosing the average of the internet is probably going to give you a picture of a white man. And Google has this filter that says, wait a second, before we share that picture that we just generated with the user, let's do some, you know, behind the scenes math and add some sort of randomness to it. Let's make sure there's, you know, a person with darker skin tone. Let's make sure there's a picture with someone maybe wearing a dress or a sweater or a Mark Zuckerberg hoodie, whatever it is, right? Like, add some more randomness. Let's make sure it's not just a picture of a white man. And it's that filter that seems to have gone awry, likely because there wasn't enough testing before it was launched.
And that's been one of the critiques of not just this Gemini image generator, but the way that Google rolled out Bard, its text-based chatbot, last spring. Its name has since been changed. But the critique is that Google is rushing here? They're rushing to launch products. What are they rushing for? Who are they chasing? What are they concerned about?
I think they would admit that themselves, that, you know, pretty much since the release of ChatGPT at the end of 2022, Google has been freaking out. They didn't expect that consumers would start to use these products the way that they have. They pushed up these timelines that they had for rolling out generative AI technologies to their services by 2 years, 3 years in some cases. That's a huge leap for them. And so they're trying to do 2 or 3 years of work in what's been now, you know, not even 18 months. And we're seeing some of the consequences of that.
Right. So the executives spoke up in this case, right? There was an outrage and some executives talked. Who should we talk about first? Should we talk about Sundar, Google's CEO?
Yeah, probably. So Sundar wrote a memo to the entire company that was, you know, shared with some media. And, you know, his point was basically that I know some of these responses have offended people and it's unacceptable, you know, this behavior that these that Gemini was doing in creating these images was unacceptable. And he said we got it wrong. I think in some senses, he's sort of trying to make sure that there's not backlash in Congress to Google and that he doesn't get dragged to a hearing where he has to explain why Gemini went woke. So that's happening a little bit. I think part of it is like a rallying cry to his own employees that we need to find a way to work even harder. We're already working hard. Let's work even harder. Let's not just do this work even faster, but somehow also make sure that we're perfect when we do it. Though he did admit that no AI is perfect, especially at this sort of emerging stage, but that Google is held to a higher bar. And we need to sort of find a way to improve, and we'll review this case. And let's see what the results of this sort of like internal audit are at the end of this and maybe a few weeks. But the key that he's worried about is losing users' trust, right? Because if users feel like they can get better quality answers elsewhere, they're going to go to other services. And that's what he has to protect against.
And then Sergey Brin spoke out as well. This is the Google co-founder. He was at something called the AGI house.
I'm sorry.
I'm waiting for my invite. He said, we definitely messed up on the image generation. I think it was mostly due to just not thorough testing. It definitely, for good reasons, upset a lot of people. So this just adds to the fray, right? Like, how significant is it that the Google co-founder has spoken up now?
It's a bit funny because from what I understand, he's been in the office very regularly. So Sergey Brin, one of the original Google co-founders, sort of flocked away from the company a little bit once Sundar Pichai became CEO and Sergey stepped back from day-to-day responsibilities. But basically, since the launch of ChatGPT, Sergey's been in the office almost every day, working closely with the teams building these models. Maybe he's spending too much time on the foundational part of it and not enough on the product side of it. Unclear what the issue is. But, I mean, he's in the midst of it. So he, you know, probably played a role in approving some of these things that then launched to consumers. So it's funny to have him come out and say, you know, like he should be owning up in part to his mistakes in this. Mm-hmm.
Right. He was using we and not as much I.
Mm-hmm. How often do either of you guys use these image generators?
Rarely. I would say rarely, maybe like once a week. So I have a Pixel phone, mm-hmm. and Gemini is on my phone, and I do have access to it. I don't have like the top tier access to it, so I can't use it for everything, but I can make images, and I've made a couple of images just to sort of show somebody what it looks like. I haven't used those images for everything. My wife runs a business, and she uses the image generator for like her newsletters and communications on her social media accounts.
Paresh, do you use them?
No, I wouldn't say that... I regularly turn to image generators in part because Mike mentioned the Adobe tool. Like that one, they've said that all the content is sort of that they train on, you know, the original images are sort of paid for, the artists or photographers are compensated. But that's not true for all the tools. And so that part sketches me out that, you know, I want to make sure content creators like us are somehow compensated. I think that's, you know, potentially important in how that shakes out. So that's one hesitation. And then two, like going to another tool when I can just search for a GIF right on, you know, the text messaging app or something, that still feels easier. But as these tools maybe get more integrated right into the apps that I already use, I'll be more inclined to use them. Mm-hmm. And I'd say third, they're just slow.
Yeah,
I don't want to sit there for like 30 seconds waiting for an image to generate.
Who has 30 seconds, really?
No one.
Sometimes the results just aren't very good. That's still look really strange.
Yes. And surreal and like kind of crunchy,
mm-hmm.
you know, like a little too many colors and the lines are too thick.
Yeah.
When you generate an image, does it say generated by AI or anything on your phone?
Yeah, there's a little watermark on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I think is also a thing that I'd want to see broadly in all the products before I start get more excited about using them. It's like, I think that disclosure is really important.
Lauren, you use these image generators all the time, right?
All the time. No, I really don't. I probably use them about as frequently as you guys both do.
Okay.
There was one time, actually, Mike, you will remember and appreciate this. Our listeners should know that Mike and I sometimes go on bike rides together. We talk. We gossip. We tape a podcast. So you just can never hear it. And there was one time recently when we were on our regular route and I said, oh, that's the DMV. Like we had ridden by it a million times. And I was like, I never knew that's where the DMV was. And we got into a conversation with our colleague Tom about this. And just for fun, we generated an image of two journalists riding a bicycle past the DMV.
And the Department of Motor Vehicles.
The Department of Motor Vehicle, a very important landmark. And this makes me laugh. I don't know why, guys. Tandem bicycles make me laugh so hard.
Yeah, it put us on a tandem.
It put us on a tandem, and we were wearing, like, business wear.
Yeah, and you were in the stoker seat.
Was I?
Yeah.
I don't know what it is about tandem bikes. Just, like, they just make me giggle. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to have a giggle fit. I'm not. It was and our faces were all distorted.
Yes.
It was very strange.
Was your prompt in a bicycle or on bicycles?
On bikes, I think. Or maybe it was just bike riding. But yeah. Well, just to bring it back to the topic at the top of the show. No, I haven't found them. I haven't found them to be particularly useful. Not yet, anyway.
Okay. Well, on that note, mm-hmm. I do want to ask one more question before we take a break. These filters that we're talking about that, you know, sort of push the chatbots in different ways. Like, we can all agree that those are good things, right? Because these tech companies should not be putting these tools out to just run rampant and spit out whatever kinds of output they feel like, right? So it's a good thing to have some sort of filter mechanism on them. But also, you put too many controls on them and they become boring and less useful. So where is the balance here? Where are these companies going to land with regards to what people are going to be able to generate, whether or not they're going to be able to ask for things like specific races, specific genders, specific things that are representative of people and actually get results that they want?
I don't know if I agree with your premise, though. Like most people, maybe many people would sort of say what Google is doing is sort of a potentially valiant effort to, you know, increase inclusion, make people feel included in these products or what they generate. But there's other ways to do it, right? Like, rather than them having these filters, they could ask you follow-up questions as part of the image generator prompt process, where it says, okay, you've asked for two people on a bicycle. Do you care what their skin color is? Do you care about this? And sort of just make it part of asking you and draw it out of you so you can get what you want out of the experience. They could optionally have just features where there's like little toggles, right? I mean, right now they probably don't do that because it costs so much to generate these images. They're probably losing money on some of these products. And so they don't have those features. And that's why I think it's important to remember that we are in that like experimental phase. But right. There's other ways to do it that are not as in your face.
That are not in anywhere.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for that. Let's take a break and we'll come back with more. Empower has the tech that can help get your money questions answered. What is your net worth? Are you saving enough? Are you on track for retirement? With the free and easy to use Empower Personal Dashboard, you can see your net worth, plan out your retirement age, track spending, create budgets, and more. And if you need a technology break, get a free second opinion by having a real live conversation with one of Empower's financial professionals to get clarity on your real life financial goals. Join 18 million Americans in Empower and take control of your financial future to empower what's next. Download the free app for Apple or Android now, or check out empower.com. It's not just the chatbots that were having a hard time at Google. It's the humans, too. Last week, Bloomberg reported that Google laid off around 10 workers out of about 250 from its trust and safety team, so a small portion of that team. Google and its parent company, Alphabet, have actually been making a lot of staffing cuts as part of a wider effort to trim costs. We talked about this broader trend of layoffs on this show 2 weeks ago. It's episode 633, if you want to know more about that. But Google's recent layoffs hit that trust and safety team at a time when those particular workers are under pressure to help correct the public faceplant of the Gemini image generator rollout. I think the best place to start this segment is to talk about what trust and safety teams do. Most of the big tech platforms have these folks working for them. So, Lauren, you've spent a lot of time reporting on trust and safety teams. I would like to ask you to walk us through what these teams do.
Trust and safety encompasses a wide range of issues on social media or service-based websites, from the nuts and bolts of things like authentication to enforcing content moderation policies, for example. You can't tweet something that incites violence or an insurrection or we'll kick you off our website, or you can't spam someone on a dating website or dating app. It also encompasses child sexual abuse material, which is a very real and disturbing problem online. And it also means ensuring that AI tools are safe and trustworthy. Now, a lot of these big tech companies use a combination now of human content moderators, some of who are employees, many who are contractors, and quote unquote automated tools, which means essentially AI. Generally speaking, these tech companies, even the big ones, probably don't have nearly enough people around to really keep things safe on the internet. So moderating AI content, generative AI content, like the kind that might be spit out by ChatGPT or Gemini, is now this kind of interesting Ouroboros of AI, because AI is used as a part of trust and safety. And now it's also the AI that needs monitoring.
Right. So this team that we're talking about at Google probably spends, we don't know how this team breaks down. So they're spending time looking at all of Google's different platforms and all of its different products. But the fact that trust and safety has been so busy on AI is something that makes these layoffs disconcerting to people on the outside.
Right. Why lay off in trust and safety right now?
Right.
But there's two things to remember. It's not just the number of people. You can have a ton of people on trust and safety, but if they're not empowered or listened to, that's mm-hmm. a big problem. And so that's been one of the complaints that we've been hearing coming out of Google the past couple of years, that they're either not given enough time to investigate things thoroughly, or they're pushed in a bunch of different directions, and so they're giving everything their half mind, or they're just not listened to, and their suggestions and ideas and criticisms are kind of just ignored and thrown out the water, and things launch and then there's problems. So I think that's important to keep in mind as well. And then there might be layoffs in trust and safety, but one place where Google has been, you know, maybe beefing up a little bit is in compliance, which is sort of adjacent. And the reason for that is there's just so many new regulations around the world that are pulling Google sometimes in conflicting directions, where like the regulators will say, Google, we want you to protect users' data more and be more private. And then on the other hand, they're saying, we want you to better foster competition. And that means opening up access to users' data. So there's that happening too, where some of this work is shifting more to a compliance side, which the trust and safety folks who are veterans of the trust and safety team are also concerned about, because they're not sure that the right things are prioritized when it moves to more of that compliance function.
Mm-hmm. And this has an impact on startups too, not just giant tech companies like Google, because if you're a little bit leaner right now and you're hiring compliance officers, people have knowledge of that space because you need to make sure that your product is in line with regulations, then maybe that's a resource that's not going towards your trust and safety team.
Right.
That sounds like maybe I'm saying that the regulation is bad. It's not, but it's an impact.
Right. Paresh, I want to ask you about the story you wrote for Wired this week about a Google employee who is bringing legal complaints against the company because she had such a poor experience working there as a person with a disability. Can you tell us a little bit about her story?
Yes. So I've covered the story of Jalon Hall, who is a Googler who started out on the YouTube content moderation team, taking down misinformation and, you know, like political stuff during the 2020 election and COVID misinformation. And then she's moved over to Responsible AI. And she alleges that she's suffered now for over 3 years racism and autism at the company because she's Black and she's deaf. And she, through sort of asking around, believes she's the only person who's ever worked at Google with those characteristics who's Black and deaf. And of course, you know, she's female, which is another thing that it's tough in the Google environment, because for years now, there's been allegations that Google hasn't done enough to respect the views of Black women in its workforce. And they do leave the company at a disproportionately higher rate than women of other races. So at the core of her story are these two things that are just like galling when you think about them. So one, when she was on content moderation, her interpreter was pushed outside of the room. So she had been relying on her interpreter to help understand speech in videos that she was trying to decide whether they should be removed from YouTube or not for violating policies. And Google said she wasn't allowed to have her interpreter there because it would create confidentiality concerns without sort of specifying too much more. And so Google hired her to be a content moderator. And then it said, you can't have your American Sign Language interpreter here. Just doesn't make sense. And Google's response is that they provide a range of accommodations and that they are committed to fostering an inclusive workplace. But certainly that situation raises concerns. And then two, to, you know, our discussion about sort of AI and responsibility, she realized when she moved to the Responsible AI team, she was doing this research project. She was interviewing users. She was doing it over Google Meet, the video chat tool, very similar to Zoom. And she realized her conversation, 90-minute conversation with this user and two interpreters who were involved with this conversation, didn't get recorded properly at all because Google Meet isn't capable of recording when someone is not speaking through their mouth, you know, vocalizing. And because she was signing with this, you know, through this interpreter, all of that was lost.
Wow.
And it's a known thing. There's complaints on Google support forums about this going back a couple of years, even before she encountered this issue. And Google said, this isn't a priority. We're not going to really, you know, address this issue. And I think that goes to show a couple of things. One, yeah, like there's a lot of things that people want. But if one of their own employees and someone who sort of needs these kinds of accommodations can't get anything, like, is there hope for the rest of us? And how Google has to think about some of these priorities and how to build in that inclusion into their product, I think it's tough. Like, how do you get the resources to do all of this? And how do you decide what to do first? And in this case, you know, this worker is saying that it amounts to unlawful discrimination.
Right.
And she is still working there.
She is. She wants to see things improve. She doesn't want to quit. And she's sort of equally committed to trying to push Google in the direction that she thinks it should be going.
Right. And that's a good effort. I mean, the law says that companies have to make reasonable accommodations for people who have disabilities. And that could be anything from a special keyboard to a special desk that's, you know, set up the way that you need it set up. And also things like interpreters, right? Mm-hmm. One of the details in your story that I thought was really interesting was that the American Sign Language interpreters come from a staffing agency. That's all mm-hmm. they provide is interpreters, right?
Yeah, Jalon says that they come from Deaf Services of Palo Alto, based here in Silicon Valley. And it raises that question of that confidentiality thing. Like, interpreters abide by a code of ethics, a code of professional conduct that says literally the first thing is confidentiality is paramount. You don't talk about clients. I've spoken to a couple interpreters. They refuse to discuss clients. Like, it seems that they really abide by that. But that isn't good enough, apparently, for Google. And if it isn't good enough, why not hire the interpreters in-house and make them sign the same NDAs that any other worker does?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's a little unclear why Google doesn't do that.
The ironic part about this is that in the past, Google has really boasted about its live transcription technology and some of its other accessibility features that give you like live captions, for example, that are supposed to be useful to the hard of hearing community. There's a dissonance between that kind of product announcement versus how they're allegedly treating a worker who is in the deaf community.
Yeah, and I think there's still a lot of work happening to improve transcriptions, but the company, as we know, is all oriented around all things Gemini right now, and inevitably that means some of these other services are going to get the squeeze, and that's possibly what's happening right now, where something like improving the captions on YouTube, which would help someone who's a deaf content moderator, just doesn't get prioritized, and as a result, you know, she can't do the job properly.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Paresh, in your reporting for the story, I'm sure you got a sense of what the general vibe is at Google among employees with, like you said, this all-in attitude on the AI tools coming at the same time as the whole industry is contracting.
Yeah, it's a little funny. People who've been at Google for a long time and survived the layoffs of the last couple of years, Google now has 8,000 less employees than it did a year ago. Those veterans who sort of survived, they're getting kind of angry. They're getting kind of disappointed. They're getting frustrated where they feel like the direction the company is going. But at the same time, Google is hiring tons of new people. There's tons of job postings for jobs related to large language models and services like Gemini, in addition to other things. And I think it feels like there's still a lot of enthusiasm to join Google. It's still an attractive place for people to work. And those newcomers are really jazzed about working with services that touch billions of users. And so it's sort of weird, it's a little divided in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the contraction of the industry, the layoffs in tech are something that have hit tech workers hard because of, I think, some of the promises that they've been fed over the years of this being a really rich industry focused on progress and growth. And also, they were promised a lot of perks with some of these jobs. And now we're seeing that big tech companies are mature. They've grown really, really fast, particularly during the pandemic. And now they're kind of obsessed with efficiencies, which Paresh talked about on our earlier podcast. And so this is happening really against a bigger backdrop of like quite a good jobs market right now. It just feels like it's hitting tech particularly hard.
Yeah. All right. Thank you both for an invigorating conversation. Listeners who are interested in reading Paresh's story about the Googler who is black and deaf and is alleging unlawful discrimination, you can find that story on Wired.com. You can also read Lauren's series of stories. It's like 2 or 3, 4 stories now.
Just a couple at this point, but my DMs are open.
Yes. So please read Lauren's stories about tech layoffs and the impact that's having on the tech industry, and send her DMs if you have more stories to tell.
Paresh too.
Paresh too.
Our DMs are open. Can I say that once more?
Yeah.
Just kidding.
Okay, let's take another break and we'll come right back with our recommendations, which are human generated. We promise. All right, welcome back. This is the third segment where we do our recommendations. We go around the table and we tell listeners something that they might find interesting. Paresh, as our guest, you get to go first. What is your recommendation?
Thank you. So I had the opportunity to try a Native American restaurant in Oakland last week. And I was sort of blown away by blue corn cake with a mixed berry compote. And it got me curious about Native American recipes. And I found, Native American recipes in general, but also how to make this blue corn cake at home. And I found one that looked pretty close. I have not tried it yet on a blog called The Fancy Navajo. So my recommendation is The Fancy Navajo blog. I think one of the more wilder recipes on there was a blue corn popsicle. very intrigued. And it is Women's History Month. So I would note that the restaurant that I went to, Huapepa's Kitchen, is owned by a female chef who says she was the first indigenous chef on the cooking program Chopped. And the Fancy Navajo is run by a female food blogger based out of Phoenix, Alana Yazzi. So
awesome.
That sounds amazing. I'm going to try to go to that restaurant this weekend.
I want the popsicle.
Yeah.
Can you make some and bring them in?
I do have the little popsicle maker things, so... Maybe. Once it gets close, when it gets warmer. It's a little cold right now.
Dude, it's any time is a good time for a popsicle.
Anytime is a good time for ice cream, not a popsicle.
Presh, you're cooking a lot on Instagram these days. I don't know. I think you're hiding a secret talent that needs to be brought out into the open here at the office.
Okay, Lauren, what is your delicious recommendation?
Not as delicious as that, I have to say. I have two recommendations. One's a quick one. There's a story out in The Guardian this week written by Lauren Meckling about a bunch of small independent news co-ops, as she calls them, that are cropping up with big media contracting. Consider reading that story and subscribing to some of these smaller outlets. She mentions 404 Media, which is doing a great job. The Defector is another one. My second recommendation is a longer one. It's an episode of the Le Carré cast, for those of you who are fans of the now late writer John Le Carré. John Le Carré wrote a lot of spy novels. He was incredibly prolific. He was also just a great writer. And so there's an entire podcast dedicated to him. But this one particular episode from late 2023 features his biographer, Adam Sisman. And Adam Sisman wrote an earlier biography about John Le Carré. And then after Le Carré died, wrote a follow-up that just really just talked about all the dark side stuff. John Le Carré, real name David Cornwell, had a very traumatic childhood. And in adulthood, he was also a prolific philanderer.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And there were lots of letters and lots of women kind of, you know, coming out of the woodwork. And this, like, inspired some of Le Carré's writing and some of the stories that, like, are now kind of famous. And I just found listening to this podcast to be completely fascinating and a really interesting portrayal of the writer. So, yeah, if you're into spy novels, if you're into John Le Carré, if you're into podcasts, I recommend checking this one out, The Secret Life of John Le Carré. And also, I just have to note, like, it feels like it was probably so much easier in the 1950s to be a spy. Yeah. Like in the books, it's like, you know, it's like, oh, and let's just cross over to East Berlin. Someone shines a flashlight in your face and here's your fake passport. And they're like, go forth, sir. No one's like, oh, I don't know. I saw you posting on Twitter. You look pretty familiar.
Yeah. We have not been tracking you on GPS.
Right. Exactly.
Geofence warrants really screw that up for everybody.
I guess so. Yeah. Text messaging, mm-hmm. wireless networks, that
and
whole
the
thing.
New thing, the push alert way of tracking people that you should read the Wired story about.
That's right. Yeah. That's with right. All of the push alerts, like a push alert could come through from something related to an abortion in a state where that is not legal. Yeah, there's a really good story out on Wired about that this week, so check that out. We'll link to that in the show notes.
Three recommendations. Mm-hmm. Solid.
Lots. Okay, Mike, what's your recommendation?
Okay, if you are a subscriber of mm-hmm. the Criterion Channel, which is the streaming network from the Film Preservation Society, known as Criterion, then you are in luck because it's Oscar season. And yes, you can go and stream all the Oscar movies, but this weekend you may be interested in streaming some of the things that are available on the Criterion Channel under the new collection of Razzie winners. So the Razzies, also known as the Golden Raspberry Award, is awarded every year for the worst movie. And Criterion has rounded up many of the past winners into a collection called And the Razzie Goes To... So you can open up this collection and watch all of these awesome Razzie Award winner movies. And it is delightful. You get movies such as Cocktail, the Tom Cruise bartender movie from the 1980s, Showgirls, Paul Verhoeven's movie about strippers, which is fantastic, by the way. Heaven's Gate, the 3.5 hour long Michael Cimino movie with Kris Kristofferson in the lead. Ishtar. Does anybody remember Ishtar?
I don't.
Sounds familiar.
Oh, was that?
Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman.
I was going to say Costner. Okay.
Prince, Under the Cherry Moon, which is terrible. I love Prince, but that movie is unwatchable.
What's so bad about it?
It's unwatchable. Mm. It's just a very poorly made movie. Sorry, Prince. R.I.P. Best guitar player
Neil
ever.
And Neil Dash is going to have something to say to you.
I'm sure he'd agree with me. Under the Cherry Moon, objectively bad. The Wicker Man. Not the 1973 original, but the Neil LaBute remake starring Nick Cage. The Bees. You know this movie?
No.
It's terrible, but it's also, it's so bad that it's good. There are a lot of movies in this collection that are so bad that they're good. There's also a lot of movies that are really bad, like Gigli, the movie with J-Lo.
Oh, with J-Lo. Yeah. What else? Give us another one.
Another one that's bad.
Yeah.
Xanadu. The Olivia Newton-John movie. Mm-hmm. A Cocktail's pretty bad. Ishtar is pretty bad. Barb Wire, the Pam Anderson vehicle from the mid-90s. That one's actually okay. Freddy Got Fingered, directed by and starring Tom Green, is a fantastic movie. If you have not seen it, you must see Freddy Got Fingered. It won a Razzie. It made sense at the time.
So it's bad.
It's bad. But it's 25. It's 23 years old. And watching it now... it's much better now than it was when it came out. It's also just extremely unhinged and weird. So I highly recommend that. Anyway, yes, Criterion people, go to your app, find And the Razzie Goes To and watch these cinematic delights that are being served up for you by these great historical film preservationists.
Are you going to tune into the actual Oscars this weekend?
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
I am too.
Maybe time delayed so I can skip all the nonsense.
An hour earlier this year, don't forget.
Oh, right, because we're jumping ahead?
Yeah, right. It's daylight savings on the 10th.
That's right.
Yeah. And a new moon, apparently.
And we've got a total eclipse coming up
it's
next month.
A lot of astrological and that's astronomical right. things happening.
We're just going to pivot this podcast to astrology.
We will not. All right. Well, that is our show. Astrology or not, Paresh, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and good luck with the for those of us that have to deal with it, the loss of an hour this Sunday.
That's right.
Yes, like Kazoo. Is Kazoo going to keep you up?
I think he's not going to be happy.
We're praying for you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. If you have feedback, you can skeet all of us on Blue Sky. Just check the show notes. Our producer is Boone Ashworth, and we will be back with a new show next week. And until then, goodbye. Now that the show is over, check out Empower's app we mentioned earlier. With the free Empower dashboard, you can see your net worth, plan out your retirement age, track spending, and more. You can also connect with Empower's financial professionals and get a free second opinion to help with your money questions. Join 18 million Americans and take control of your financial future to empower what's next. Download the free app for Apple and Android devices now or visit empower.com.